Many of you have seen the Blue Wisp Big Band performing in the greater Cincinnati area for decades. But did you know that the drummer, John Von Ohlen, is revered by drummers and other musicians across the country? Tonight we brought together a number of musicians for a roundtable discussion about the Baron in the studio of WVXU. The moderator of this celebration of John Von Ohlen is Robin Carey Allgaier, along with musicians Jeff Hamilton, Carmen De Leon, Steve Schmidt, Lee Stoller, and Bob Nave.
Let's go around the table. Start with Lee Stoller.
Well, I think I'll start with some anecdotes. About 2 years ago, I went to the Elkhart Jazz Festival, and I went to hear Shelley Berg's group, and I went up to Steve Houghton, who was his drummer, and I said, "My drummer, John Von Ohlen, just loves you." And he said, "John Von Ohlen," his face lit up like, he said, "John is one of my heroes." And the bass player, Lou Fisher, overheard us, and he said, "You kidding? That boy invented the word swing." Another time I was out at the West Coast Jazz Party in Newport Beach. I was talking to Benny Green, and I mentioned John, and he says, "Oh, please give him my love. I so enjoyed playing with him last year," or whenever it was that John went out there. Last year, I went up to Jake Hanna, and I mentioned John's name.
Uh-oh, we're going to have to edit. Oh, we're going to have to edit this one.
Yeah, but as you all know, you have to edit when you're quoting Jake. But he said, "Tell him to get his you-know-what out here. We miss him."
That's right.
Well, I'm Bob Nave, and I've enjoyed John's drumming for many, many years. And most folks here in Cincinnati know John as being the drummer with the Blue Wisp Big Band, and also a few years ago doing the trio sessions at the Wisp. And what I think folks would like to know, John, is how'd you get here? From where did you start? And kind of tell us a little bit about your journey to Cincinnati.
Well, but that's a good long story. Well, you know, when I got off the road, I'd been on the road basically for 12 years. And so I wanted to settle down. My hometown's Indianapolis. So I went back to Indianapolis, started a little group, quartet. And you remember that one?
Was that Steve Elliott?
Yeah. And then
Top of the Hilton or something like that.
Yeah, we did that. And then I started coming down here. And I think the reason was is because somebody hired me for a show down here. And so I set up the drums at rehearsal. Sadler and Young, I think, was the show. Al Norai, Don Johnson were in the trumpet section, Rudy Minetti. So Al Norai, I didn't know anybody. And so Al, you'd love this guy, but he walked by my drum set at the intermission of the rehearsal, and he didn't even stop. He just kept walking, and I had that great big cymbal with the cuts out of it, you know. He didn't even look at me. He just kept walking. He says, "Was a dinosaur been scarfing on your cymbal, man?" So I said, "I got to move down here. These are my people." So it was basically that.
So I was trying to remember, was it 77 or 78 that the big band got started?
It was 80, wasn't it?
Started out as an accordion player?
Well, yeah, but you know, I was 4 years old. But then we got a piano and had more keys.
Trombone in there too?
Oh yeah, and I love trombone, still do.
Yeah,
sometimes when I'm setting up the drums, I wish I'd have stayed with it.
Well, we're very pleased and honored to have a seldom visitor to Cincinnati. Drummer Jeff Hamilton drove in from Indiana to be a part of this tribute to John Von Ohlen. So welcome.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here. I don't get to Cincinnati much, so especially for honoring John here. So speaking of trombone, there's one funny story. He went to Cologne with John Friend, my cohort in the Clayton Hamilton Jazz Orchestra. And they were at the Europa Hotel right on the circle there. Clayton's room was over John Von Ohlen's. So it was like 12 or 12:30 or something at night, I think. And Clayton laid his head down on the pillow to go to bed, and he hears, yeah, nails. Yeah, baby. And he opens the door, and he walks out on the balcony, and he looks down at VO, and VO's got the headphones on singing to the tape. And John Clayton says, "Hey, VO," he says, "dig this third trombone part, baby." You know, and it, and it also reminded me of when I studied with John, him telling me, you know, you just can't play the charts from the drum chair. You got to get all the way inside the music. And that means listening to the third trombone part and know what they're doing and every instrument in the band. So I had a little special chuckle with that one because it's he doesn't just tell you what you should do. He lives what you should do also. So
you studied with the Baron.
Boy, did I.
It was about a year solid every week.
It was 8 months.
8 months.
Seemed like a year to
it
you.
It seemed like it, yeah. but I remember all we talked about, or all I talked about, was the right hand on the cymbal. That was it. You know, I just kept doing that in different ways you could do it, you know. And Jeff was the best student I ever had because, I don't know, he just had an innate savvy of the drum set. He had it organized in his head, and I didn't have to teach him that. And whatever I told him to do, I never could give him anything to work on because he'd just do it right then. I never sent him home and said, work on this, because he'd just do it.
I think the real reason you're saying that is because I brought cash for the lessons, and so
could be
all $8. It was $8.
Well, that's a lot. Back then.
Well, listen, that's why I got stuff like that. I couldn't afford to come back.
So, how old were you?
I was 18. Yeah, 19 maybe.
19. Yeah.
I had gone to IU and didn't make a jazz band my first year. Some hack named Peter Erskine beat me out of the top band. And I say that lovingly. We're good friends and have been for many years. Bill Molinoff, the marimba player, was in the third band. And so he decided he wanted to concentrate on marimba, so I got into the third band my second semester, and I was a total Buddy Rich clone at the time. I mean, it was like I had studied snare drum for 5 years, so I had all these machine gun chops from the time I was 8 years old. But I hit the ride cymbal, and it was like ding, 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 and nothing was happening. So that's why John had to spend 8 months with me on the ride cymbal. I saw him on the Kenton band when he sat in at Madison Heights High School gym in Anderson, and Jerry McKenzie, Jerry McKenzie, the cop,
that night.
Was playing. And I really loved Jerry McKenzie's playing. You know, we kind of looked similar. You know, he was kind of blonde and played black drums. And I like this guy. And then Stan said, now we'd like to bring out the great John Von Olin to rap. And the place went crazy. And I thought, gee, I don't know John Von Olin. You know, who is this? And somebody said, oh, he used to play on the band. Had a white suit on that night, and this is before Travolta made it hip, and he had the black shirt and the white suit, and he came out and he played Malaguena, and he just ripped up the mambo beat. And I thought, how can you play that fast? And so I thought, I got to check this guy out some more. My two roommates at school wanted to put together a group like he had, the group The Baron, with two keyboards. And so they said, but you got to get that style down, because we don't need Buddy Rich blowing out the windows in this band. That's when I started driving up to Indianapolis two or three nights a week to hear you guys. Mm-hmm. And I walked up to him the first night. I said, I have to take lessons with you. When can I start? And he says, well, I don't teach. Well, okay, but I got to take a lesson with you some. Well, just listen to the band. Just come up and listen to the band. So I did. And finally, the drum shop that I was buying stuff from, Fred Gehry, Fred's drum shop, said, John Von Olin's going to start teaching here. I said, sign me up. I think I was the first guy that signed up. And that's when I started taking the lessons. And I dropped out of IU because I was learning more from him than I was at school. And 8 months later, I went on the Tommy Dorsey band. So that's another funny story because I turned it down. I was waiting on Count Basie and Woody Herman, So I went for a lesson. John says, well, what's been going on lately? And I said, Well, I got an offer to go on a Tommy Dorsey Ghost band, but I don't want, you know, 19 and stupid. And I said, I don't want to do that. I'm waiting for Woody and Basie. And he says, well, what experience have you had? The IU Jazz Ensemble? Why don't you go out and learn how to treat a band? Who's the leader? I said, Murray McEachran. He says, you don't know who Murray McEachran is? Being a trombone player. He filled me in on that. 18-year-old lead trombone player with Benny Goodman out of Canada, Glenn Gray and the Casaloma Orchestra. And he just gave this wealth of information about who I should be on the road with. So I drove back to Bloomington, and I called John Clayton, who had called me. He was the contact for Murray McEachran. And I said, hey, John, is that Tommy Dorsey gig still open? He says, I knew you'd call back.
Really? My last lesson with Jeff at that drum shop, though, was interesting because, you know, we'd been really getting into the ride cymbal and really nothing else. And I think he was getting sick and tired of it, you know. But I still kept hammering away at it. So the last lesson, I showed him all my licks and sent him all out. That was it. I wanted to mention something about Jeff being with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. You know, Jeff is a world-class drummer now, and he's really the talk of all the students in colleges where I teach, and Jeff is it. And I kind of realized that these drummers nowadays don't have the opportunity we had to play for dancing, you know, because if you think about all the great bebop drummers came up, Max and Art Blakey, you know, they grew up playing for dancing.
Playing swing music.
Yeah, because you had to learn how to get the audience going and to keep their feet happy, you know, with your beat. Because if you didn't, they'd walk off the floor. And it was very obvious. So now, when Jeff plays, he's got that under his belt, you know, and he has quite a bit of experience doing that. And see, they never talk about that in the jazz schools, about playing for dancing. Because really, you can't do it much anymore.
Well, it's not only just having that information that you need to do it. It's like you have to sit in a room with a full dance floor.
Yeah.
And Freddie Green told me when I was on the Basie band, we had like four dances in a row, and I wanted the hot concert stuff. You know, we could rip into the Heat's On and all the Whirly Bird and stuff.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, four dances in a row, huh, Freddie? And he says, oh, you don't like dances? And I said, oh, no, I do. You know, and I did. But it was 4 hours, and it was all kind of, you know, dance tempo with that band. It was great doing it. But I said, yeah, but I like to play some of the other concert stuff. And he says, oh, I'll take a dance any old day of the week. I said, what do you like about dances? He said, in the first tune, I find me the couple that I'm going to stick with all night, and I ride them all over the dance floor, and I don't even have to think about what I'm doing.
Yep.
And those are the nights of my life. Those are the best nights. And I did it that night, and it worked. I didn't even have to think about what I was doing.
My best moments with Stan Kenton were the dances, by far. Out in Iowa at some country club, you know, and you'd pick out a couple, you know. And I remember this real aristocratic couple, you know, that probably never heard Stan Kenton in their lives. And we were playing a Lenny Niehaus chart on Gigi. And we got to the big grandiose thing at the end, and this lady, she had her hair up. She was very aristocratic looking. And she moved her head back right at the climax, you know, and I just thought, I'll never forget that. So it's wonderful to see that and to see them on the dance floor.
I definitely wanted to introduce someone who knows a little bit about playing for dancers.
Carmen's sitting there mute.
Carmen DeLeon is with us. Carmen also, of course, this is his 40th anniversary as music director for Cincinnati Ballet this year. So congratulations.
Yes, I've been wrong.
I'm not very good at storytelling, but I, you know, remember the first time I've saw him, and it was mainly, well, when I heard him, I heard this wonderful ride cymbal sound, and I thought, wow, what's going on? And I saw this humongous cymbal with this huge moon-shaped chunk out of it that Norai described perfectly. And I thought, well, I got to go home and do that to one of my cymbals, maybe to make it sound like that. I don't know. But I, over the years, I've just been trying to learn a thing or two just by observing him.
Carmen gave me really one of the best inspirational comments that anybody ever said to me. And it was when I was here in Cincinnati playing with the Bluest Big Band, but I made this record with Bill Walters.
Oh, yeah, it was the Bill Walters thing.
Yeah. And he had a bunch of Frank Sinatra kind of charts, and Carol DeCamp made them all great charts. And we had essentially the Bluest Big Band. And I had been working on something, and it was just an inner study with myself. I hadn't told anybody about it or anything, you know, but I was working on it. And it was starting to, I thought, come around, but I wasn't sure.
Tommy Dorsey's Opus Number 1.
so we made that record, and I used that way of playing. And then I didn't think any more about it. Carmen, when I saw him a few months later, he came up and nailed me about that record. I mean, he heard it right away, what I'd been doing. Boy, I mean, I went home, I said, thank you, Carmen. You know, at least somebody hears it.
Well, I think part of it was what John always is able to do. Most of us just sort of play the licks that we've known for years, and we're not thinking a lot about what we're doing. But John is able to pre-program what's going to be happening. He has a way of setting up the music so that you know, well, the sax section is coming in now, or it's the lower brass, or it's just a kick in the high brass. You can hear it in his drums even before it happens. Like, he signals it in advance by some magical means that I don't know what's going on.
It's called Mel Lewis.
Well,
and it still has that element of sneakers in the dryer.
Where
it's like, oh, is it gonna come out here? And you know it's gonna come out there. You know, so it's a perfect setup, but it's that zaniness to it. It's like, okay, safe.
Well, I want to mention the Mel Lewis thing too, because I know John idolized the guy and mentions a time when he first heard Mel Lewis play, and I had the same experience. It was when Mel was with the Jerry Mulligan Concert Big Band. That night was like a revelation, just to hear how a drummer can disappear somehow. You didn't even know he was there, but there was just this cloud, this fluffy thing that the entire band was playing on top of, and that's something that we all aim for. That influence, and Elvin Jones was the other influence too, totally different and separate, but just magical.
Yeah. I thought I would mention, I trust John. When John is there, I can relax and do my thing, do the singer's thing, which is probably what I do best anyway. I trust John to know where I'm going and what I'm doing. John is very sensitive to the melodies, to the rhythms. You can hear it when he plays. He knows what's coming up. And sometimes when the bass player is soloing, I try not to get busy behind him, just kind of give him some things here and there. And if I play a rhythmic thing, John is right there with me. He knows what's coming next. And occasionally I just turn around and grin at him because he catches everything that goes on. His ears are a yard wide.
I can tell you the secret to that, but all these drummers that are listening have to send $8 to John Von Olin for this lesson, because John told me this in a lesson. He said, you know, when you play, and a lot of times drummers hunch over, and I was trying to be like Buddy Rich when I was a kid and was going to the chiropractor at 12 years old for back problems and stiff necks, and you know, and first thing he said was sit up straight, oh, this is your furnace, your energy in here, and let the limbs flail.
Yeah, I remember that.
Off of your body, this is your torso, and in doing that, also, you breathe better, and all the ideas get to your head, the blood flow is better, but mentally, take yourself out of yourself and stand behind you while you're at the drums. And take everybody in on the bandstand and the audience. You're aware of everything that's going on all the time. And that was such a big... I'm not giving away your secret, am I? Here, I got $8. I'll give you $8. But that's a tool that I think of all the time when I'm on the bandstand. And sometime I could slap him, because if there's somebody talking right in front of the drums, I'm very aware of that too. You know, you're aware of everything. Your antenna are out, and it's like... live wires. You're responding and you're sending out messages all the time, and that was so helpful to me for what he said. And
I asked Mel Lewis one time, I said, you know, I was just picking his brain, I said, when you're playing, I said, if there's one thing that you concentrate on, what would it be? And he said, he kind of thought for a second, he said, everything but myself.
Because we never like the way we sound, you know. We're always dogging it. Oh man, I should have played that there.
And then, no, he said I just play naturally, and then he said I just listen. That's all. Just listen and play. Very simple.
Mm-hmm. A number of years ago, there was an NPR program on Miles. It was a retrospective, not too long before he died, and they interviewed Art Blakey, and Blakey said, you know, in the old days, we didn't have amplifiers and all kinds of monitor speakers and everything. We had one microphone out in front of the band. And he said it made you a better drummer, because you're not playing for yourself. You're playing for the soloist. You got to listen to them. And that's what John does so well, and of course Jeff as well. These guys listen.
You got to hear it. You know, you can't play with it if you can't hear it.
Absolutely.
And Philly Joe told me that. I took a lesson with him for $9, by the way. Yeah. And that was in 76. And he said, you're not challenging. I was playing with Monty Alexander and John Clayton at the time. And you implied this at the time, that I wasn't challenging them enough. I was kind of a doormat and just playing time and being comfortable. That's what I'd heard on Monty's records, you know, and as a piano trio, I thought that's what I'm supposed to do. And I got this stupid 21 mini cup that you hated. And
oh, yeah.
Oh, you hated that cymbal. And so I played this. We played Jilly's down in the hotel or the basement of that hotel when he was there temporarily. And John says, you got to get rid of that cymbal, man. That's not, you know, that's not making it at all. Then Philly Joe, a year later, said, get a cymbal that you can get on, you know, and play and bring the sound, all the sound of the cymbal out, to wrap it around the band, which is what we talked about also, and challenge those guys. I said, but he's paying me. Monty doesn't, I don't think, he says, well, then get another job, you know, but send out something to him that he can grab onto. And I said, but if I do that, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to hear him. And he said, that's another thing. That's volume. The good gauge for volume is if you can hear everybody acoustically, which is in your world all the time, you know, everybody's acoustic. If you can hear everybody acoustically, then you're not playing too loud. Not gauging your sound on the amp, but with the natural sound of their instrument. And that's what I go by.
Tell them what the Philly Joe gave you, a brush lesson.
Oh, yeah.
Tell them about that.
Well, that's a visual, too. I'll do my best. But, you know, he had this stroke called the palm up, so he would turn his right hand like he's turning on the ignition, and he'd bring the brush up so the palm is facing the ceiling, and he'd bring it around his hair. This is the one you're talking about, right? And like he's combing his hair, you know, and then back down the left arm onto the drum again, and then flip the wrist up. And he says, you got to get that hand up there, comb your hair. And I had this big mop of, you know, blonde afro at the time, you know, and I'm trying to avoid that. And so I came down about chest level on the rise, and he's, No. Get the hand up there. Comb your hair. And I said, okay. So I felt, you know, dumb, 21 years old, and I'm this show drummer, you know, bringing the hand up here. And I said, is that it? And he says, yeah, that's it. And I said, why do I have to bring the hand all the way up there? And he says, because. And he slams the brush on the drum. He says, you've got to be pretty when you play the brushes.
Yeah. That's a great one, boy.
You're listening to a celebration of John Von Olin on 91.7 WVXU. During this roundtable, Jeff Hamilton discussed being in the movie Good Night and Good Luck about Edward R. Murrow.
And George Clooney directed that. So they took me in for a shearing, and the beard was gone, and I had a 1950s haircut, and I kind of looked like Spanky on the Little Rascals, you know. But it was all for the movie, done in the 50s. So I found old Leedy drums and old K cymbals and Gene Krupa brushes. Everything was authentic, and my finest work was on the cutting room floor. I never made it visually in the film, but we're playing in the film. Well, George was so hip during the shoot. They were ready for the actual shot, and they'd say, okay, here we go, we're ready to get this. He says, yeah, just a second. He says, man, is that Blue Wisp band still happening down there? You know, and we ended up talking about Von Olin and Aunt Rose, you know, for most of the break.
Aunt Rose,
yeah. It was one of the greatest experiences. I thought, man, Von Olin's going to be with me the rest of my life. It doesn't make any difference where I go. You know, somebody's got a story about him, which is wonderful. It's just like
we had Rosie's funeral, you know, out here in Maysville. Mm-hmm. Yeah, George came up to me. He said, they'll let anybody in, won't they?
Well, we're joined by Steve Schmidt, pianist with Blue Wisp Big Band.
It's great to be here.
I remember Steve, when he first started playing at the Blue Wisp, you know, I don't know how old you were. You pretty young.
Yeah, I mean, I was like 22, I guess.
Yeah, but he was a garage band rock and roll guitar player. And then all of a sudden he got into playing bebop tunes on the piano. And so I came into the Blue Wisp as the house drummer, you know, it was a gig. So Steve wanted to name the group the John Von Olin Trio. I said, no, it's got to be the piano player. So, you know, we played for a few months, and he was playing great bebop, but he didn't know too many tunes. So New Year's Eve, we had people there, you know, and come 12 o'clock midnight, we were supposed to play Auld Lang Syne. Well, Steve didn't know it, so we didn't play it.
Sorry, folks. Wait. Well, thanks.
Did anyone know we're not... at that time of the evening?
Yeah, really.
But subsequently, you've learned the tune.
Yes, I have. So. Okay. No, I remember the first night we ever played together, because we did play trio before the big band started for a couple months. Alex Siren was playing bass, and you had just moved to town from Harrisburg, and I guess I had known about you, and a couple times when I'd been playing at Ammonon, another club, you had come and sat in, but I had never played with you that much, and I'll never forget that first night. It was just magical, liberating. I was like, wow, I didn't know.
When did Seaton come in?
You know, could swing like this, you know?
Michael left, right? And we were looking for a bass player, and you remembered Lynn from some jam session we had. Because Lynn's from Oklahoma,
right?
And he came up here to see his sister. And so he played that night. And I didn't think much about it, but when we had to get a bass player, Steve and I were talking, and Steve said, well, what about that bass player that sat in, you know, at the session? And then you said he was from Oklahoma. You knew how to get a hold of him.
Right.
So I called him. And he was playing in an acid rock band. And I said, well, we got a gig for you 5 nights a week if you want it. It's a jazz gig. And he said, well, I don't want to, you know, mess these guys up. So, you know, I said, well, fine. Well, about 10 minutes later, he called back and he says, I want the gig. You know, he changed his mind just like that.
Yeah, it was probably maybe a year after we
like
started playing together.
Like 82 or something, I was thinking.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, we're talking about the great Lynn Seaton, the bass player. Yeah, so he was with us, I don't know, what, 2 or 3 years, right?
Maybe five or so.
Maybe five. Actually.
Yeah, that hookup was great. That trio was really something to come in.
I told Lynn when he left, he went with
Woody.
Yeah, I told him, I said, when you left town, you took my right arm with you.
Yeah.
He liked to play bowed solos. And I couldn't stand his bow work. I just couldn't stand it, you know. And so, you know, like when we'd be playing, you know, backing up somebody, playing time, whatever, he'd have that bow in a holster there. You know, when he wasn't looking, I'd take it out and put it over on the other side of the drum. But the end of that story, though, was years later after he left town, many years, I heard something on a radio station, and this guy played a bow, you know, solo. And I said to myself, I said, now Lynn Seaton ought to listen to this guy. Well, it was Lynn.
Well, Michael Scharf, bassist, bass player in town, wanted to be here, but he's tied up. But he had a question. He wanted me to ask. He said, why can't anyone else play your drums?
Because I sabotage them, especially when Jeff comes to town.
Yeah. Well, explain that.
Oh, I don't know. Every drummer, and I mean every drummer, is completely different than the next drummer. You know, they like them tuned different. Like, a lot of guys like to have their drums tuned up kind of high. Well, I just can't stand it. Like, when I hit that head and it's that tight, and it doesn't have to be very tight at all, it just backs up on my nervous system. I can't stand it. So I like it as super low as I can get it. And plus, I think the sound I get is because when I was a kid, I used to pretend that I was playing the Arthur Godfrey Show. It was every morning at 10 o'clock. And I'd come down with I didn't have a drum set, but I had the coat hanger cylinders, you know, the cardboard things. And I'd bring them down every morning, 10 o'clock, and I'd pretend I was the drummer on that show. Well, I was sitting on this couch. I remember, you know, flap, you know, hitting the couch like that, you know. I think that's the sound I'm still trying to get.
That's also the feel you get when you play your
drums. Just flapping, low, loose sound, you know.
Well, John also has his snare drum still tilted like at the marching drum angle.
Yeah, so I'm not doing it quite that much anymore. But
the one sound that I hear, which I love to hear, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, it's the sound you're going for on your bass drum at the end of a tune when we're playing the final chord and you're doing some bombs and stuff. Anyway, the bass drum, it sounds like at the end of fireworks. I told you this the other week. You know, like when you're at a fireworks show and the big finale is like those big low things like poof, 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 you know. It sounds like that. It's a good thing.
It is a good thing.
I have a question for you. We have two fantastic drummers. And by the way, if I had a drum student, nobody would ever come to me to study drums. But if they did, I would just tell them to buy the DVD from the live concert in Paris with Jeff playing that program. There are a lot of close-up shots of him working, and it's just so easy. I mean, it just flows. It's so beautiful. That's how you should study to be a drummer, I think. It's wonderful. What do both of you guys think about solos? You're talking about somebody who dislikes solos a lot. Mm-hmm. So when somebody says, okay, here it is, we're going to give the drum some room, in your brain, are you saying, oh, God, here we go again, I have to fill up this time? Or are you excited about the possibility of what you might create?
Well, Jeff's got this thing in his back pocket. See, I mean, he's got the musical thing, with the Mel Lewis thing, or whatever you want to call it. But then he's also got dynamite in his back pocket. You know, he can come out with that. And
from those 5 years he spent...
he's playing when he was a Buddy Rich clone.
Yeah.
That's where he got that.
So you relish it then?
Well, I've never been afraid of a solo, but what I had to really learn that John helped me through was that a drum solo is not the time for you to display all the tools. You know, play the music, play the form of the tune, keep the melody in mind. You know, if you're going to play Gentle Rain, you don't come out and machine gun during the drum solo. It's Gentle Rain. We all are lost, alone in the world, walk with me like the gentle rain. So you're not going to, you know, I mean, it's just got to be a gentle solo. So play the tune and honor the tune for what it is. Serve the music is what I always keep in mind on a solo. And I want to keep the band interested in what I'm playing, and I want the audience to be interested in what I'm playing. So I'm not afraid to use fragments of the melody to keep everybody involved in the solo, because everybody knows the song we're playing. They recognize the melody, and without being corny, of course, hopefully, but just to kind of let people know where I am, to frame the phrases in the solo, and that embraces everybody on the bandstand and in the audience. So that's mainly what I'm thinking when I'm playing a solo. And just to tell people what kind of day I've had and breathe. This is all Von Ohlen. This is all just play the music and be who you are, and you have an opportunity to say what you want to say, serve the music, and it's, you know, you don't have to worry about how it's going to sound at the end. If you're not worrying about it while you're playing it and you're listening to everybody else, it's all going to sound okay at the end. So you're always able to live with what you played that way. Instead of
when I play a solo, sometimes it's just nothing happening, you know, and nothing comes to me. So I think I told Bobby Haggard one time, I said, you know, I think I figured out I got 12 licks. And Bobby said, well, you're lucky. But
I distinctly heard 13.
That's that new one.
And that was on a ballad.
Right. But anyway, when I'm playing a tune, yeah, I do that, especially with a small group. Sometimes I might have a big concert drum solo with a big band, like Stan Kenton tribute things I did. And I'll spend the whole day figuring out what I'm going to do, not what I'm going to play, but how I'm going to approach it, you know. And then I'll get completely away from the form and just play a sound solo. Sometimes I'll start out with the form and then just kind of break it and then just start playing anything.
One of the great lessons was Jay Cummings was studying with you at the same time, and a couple other guys around Indianapolis, and you got all of us together at Fred's drum shop one afternoon, Sunday afternoon. There was one drum set in the room, and he said, okay, I want everybody to just create sound. I don't want to hear any time. I don't want to hear any of your licks or any preconceived ideas. Just create sound for 2 minutes. And man, we started running for some clean underwear, because we'd never done that before. You know, it's like, well, how do we create sound? And he took us out of that box of having to play 8-bar phrases, and we could see everybody just opening up at that time and thinking, okay, now. Then the next thing was, he snapped his fingers in time. He said, just keep playing sound. Don't think about the time. I'm your time, and you create all these sounds around the time. I'm giving away all your secrets. Yeah. You hate me now.
That was it.
You?
That, yeah. Was it.
And then you listen back to it, and there was this total freedom that ended up sounding like musical ideas and phrases, because the time was making that. It was going from the other way. Instead of thinking, here's the time and create, it was create and then here's the time. So that was very valuable, to just let your sound develop that way.
I think what happened to me is, I'd been on the road for years playing with great bands and lousy bands. And when I came back to Indianapolis, I had a lot of time on my hands. I was by myself. I wasn't married or anything. So I started to just play all day long. You know, I'd play the records for a while, and then I'd just solo or just anything. But I started getting into the sound thing on the cymbal. And so instead of worrying about whether I'm rushing or dragging, which is a constant worry, I guess, with drummers,
I would, until you just don't care anymore.
Well, until, yeah, you don't care what anybody thinks.
Right.
But you can't fake that. You gotta mean it.
You gotta mean it.
So I started playing sound on the cymbal beat. It was the same beat, but I thought sound, like the tip of the stick hitting the metal on the cymbal, and get the best sound you could get, not the best time, the best sound. And it seemed like that if you're getting a good sound, you're probably playing pretty good time, you know. So it kind of erased that whole problem of, you know, worrying about time. And I kept doing that for years at the Blue Whist with Steve. And I'd do it all night. I'd concentrate on that 100%. One night, I was playing. I wasn't drinking or anything. I was take all that out. And then all of a sudden, it just kind of opened up, and there was this big slot there, you know. And I just dropped my stick in the pocket or in that slot. And, boy, I knew I had it then. You know, it was there, you know, no doubt about it. And then the next night, that didn't happen, so I went back to playing sound.
Went back to drinking.
Yeah, right. So I went back to playing sound, and for a couple or 3 months, you know, I was back doing that. Then about 3 months later, it did it again, exactly the same thing. It opened up. It was just like a
Moses
parting of the Red Sea, you know. And I just dropped my stick in there. And then that kept happening, and now I can kind of do sound only or that pocket, you know.
I'd like to pick up on something Jeff was saying about constructing his solos. In a larger sense, it kind of falls into the category of context. And this is something that John does so well working behind Mary Ellen, for instance. A lot of great musicians here in town do not understand why she isn't comfortable with anybody else. You have to have a jazz feel to do what she does. But if you treat it like a jazz job, you're going to be in her way. You're going to cover her up, bury her, and she is not going to be happy. She's going to turn around to me and say, "Hope he enjoyed his first and last night."
Yeah.
But John knows that, and I'm not saying that Mary Ellen sounds like Rosemary, but John knows we're not thinking Betty Carter here. We're thinking Rosemary Clooney. There's a difference. It's called context. And John always knows what to do in context. He knows who he's playing with.
You'll never know just how much I miss you. Never know just how much I care. And if I tried, I still couldn't hide my love for you. You ought to know, for haven't I told you so a million or more times? You went away and my heart went with you. I speak your name in my every prayer. If there is some other way to prove that I love you, I swear I don't know how. You'll never know if you don't know. Thank you. I speak your name in my every prayer. If there is some other way to prove that I love you, I swear I don't know how. You'll never know. No, no.
I guarantee he plays differently with Steve than he plays with me or Phil DeGreg or anybody else, because we all play differently and he approaches us differently.
One of the students that I had, this hot shot who's gone on to become this really terrific drummer, his name is Kevin Canner.
Oh, yeah.
And he's playing with Bill Holman's band and was on the last Grammy nomination that Bill had last year. And he said, man, I wish Mel Lewis was still alive. You know, he was like 18 or 19. And he said, I'd like to see the lineage of where you came from. And I said, well, go to Cincinnati. You know, I played the Von Ohlen stuff for you. I said, you can't see Mel, but you can see Von Ohlen. And he said, really? Do you think he'd take me as a student? He was like real green, you remember, yeah. A cute kid. So I got his parents' permission to fly back with him. I had a gig in Indianapolis with my trio, and I dropped him off with John. And I said, now go in with a legal pad full of questions, and I want you to ask exactly what you want, and he'll give you the answers to that. You know, but if you go in and say, okay, just teach me, he's going to say, well, what do you want to talk about? You know, so go in and get ready. So he has his 20 questions on a yellow legal paper. So I pick him up after the lesson. I said, so how was it? And he goes, man, he's so deep. I don't think I've ever met anybody that deep. And I said, so he gave you all the information, right? And he says, well, kind of. And I said, well, what did he say? And he says, well, so the first question was, what do you think about when you're playing time? And he says, well, I think about when the stick hits the cymbal. Okay. I looked at question number two. Well, what do you think about when you're playing fills in a big band? Well, I think about where the stick hits the cymbal. Okay. And he said, by the fifth question, I finally got it. That's the focus, is of where and when that stick. And you mentioned that earlier. It's where that stick hits the cymbal. Mm-hmm. That's the beginning of everything. Because as he told me, when you're playing solos, have that third arm coming out going dag-a-dang, dag-a-dang, dag-a-dang on the ride cymbal, and you don't have to worry about, you don't have to think about your musical phrases or anything. That's automatic for you. So,
you know, the funny thing is I've been doing it for, 50 years, and I'm working 5 nights a week now, you know, and I still look forward to the gig so I can go boom, tickety-boom, tickety-boom, you know.
That's something else you pointed out. You know, he said there, and I didn't get this when I was a kid, he said, you're a drum player. He said, there are cymbal players, and then there are drum players. And he says, you're really a drum player, because I had all that rudimental stuff, and I could just apply it around the drum set. Cymbals were there to crash, you know, every once in a while, hit with the bass drum. So I talked to him about it a little more. I was thinking about it, and he said, there are drummers whose playing start with the ride cymbal and the sound they get on the ride cymbal, and then that goes through everything that you do. Then there are drummers who start with a snare drum, and that goes from there. And so I really made it a goal of mine to change that and be a cymbal player and let all the music develop from the cymbals instead of from the drums out. And it's almost like gathering, I think, of embracing the whole instrument and bringing it home instead of starting with the drums and pushing it out.
Mm-hmm.
So... and your ride cymbal, you know, that it's one bounce, and you just one motion, and you'll let the stick bounce for three, dang it. And so I thought, okay, some of these kids are not getting this. How can I make it easy? So most people sing their ride cymbal as dink-da-dink, dink-da-ding, or tuck-a-da, or sing-da-spink-de-ding, or whatever, you know. And I'm thinking, these are really staccato beats. You know, how can I get them to lengthen their cymbal beats? So I started, day-ga-day. So everything was open-ended. So day, day-ga-day, day-ga-day, day-ga-day. And that's your motion in three bounces. So this kid from Australia comes over to study with me, and I sang the ride cymbal beat to him. I said, sing your... He says, boink, doink, da, doink, doink, da, doink. I said, oh, no, no. Okay. All right. I said, I wrote it out for him. D-A-Y-G-A-H, D-A-Y, day, day, g-day. And he just looked at me. And I said, what's the matter with you? And he says, Mate, you want me to say day, day, g'day, day, g'day? Oh,
that's nice.
That's like, oops.
That's great. Yeah. What equipment do you play?
Basically, Gretsch drums. My big band bass drum was made formerly by Jimmy Rupp. I'm using Bosporus cymbals, and I got one Istanbul cymbal. And then that big 25, which is a very, very old A. Zildjian. And it's probably 1951.
And it's a 23 now.
Yeah. Actually, it's 25 one way and 25 and a half the other way.
You know, I always like to think of John's drums being like wine, because you sit on wine and you age the wine, and it gets better the more you age it. And the best sound I think he ever got was when I first met him. And he left his drums in the back of his DeSoto. He called it his jazz car, you know. And the rain would get in there, and the shells would get a little wet sometimes. And he'd set them up in the gear. I think, man, these are going to sound awful. And they were the greatest sounding drums you'd ever heard. So, you know, he knew how to age his drums in the DeSoto.
Well, there was another thing I asked you about the other night, which I hadn't thought about for a while, was that drum seat that you used to have when you first started playing at the Blue Wisp. And I don't know, one night you turned it over and there was like bubble gum just stuck.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
Almost every bit of space was taken
probably
by
100 pieces of petrified gum.
It was like, I guess, did you actually chew it, put it there, and then and then pick it up again? And
No, okay. I didn't do that.
That's how you got the brushes so fast, just under the throat.
That was amazing.
So where can folks hear you, John?
I'm at DeFelice's with Lee Stoller on Thursday night with the trio. And then Friday and Saturday, the Bill Gimmer Quintet. And then Sunday with Mary Ellen, Shay Nora, and Lee Stoller. And then the big band
on
Wednesday night, the Blue Wisp.
How do you handle all this?
I don't know. I'm working as much now as I did in the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, steady work.
Yeah. That's why I had to leave Indiana. There wasn't any work. He was working six nights every place. Between you and Guilfoyle, I had to go on the Tommy Garcia band. I wanted to play.
What's up next for you, Jeff?
What's up next? I just recorded a trio CD with Tamir Hendelman and Christoph Ludi. I just got out of the studio from 9 days with Barbara Streisand. And did a Diana Krall benefit with James Taylor and Elvis Costello and Elton John.
Benefit for Diana?
No, it's for a hospital. She raises money for a hospital in her mother's honor. It's the Krall Cancer Center in Vancouver. Mm. So getting ready to gear up for a Diana Krall month-long tour to promote the new CD that's coming out this month. And a new DVD you can add to the Paris collection. We did it in Brazil last fall. So that takes me up to summer. And
domestic tour? Or?
Canada only, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then U.S. in the summer with her.
Any last stories?
A lot of people don't know this, but John was something of a prodigy on piano. Many years ago, I was at the Playboy Club. We had to play the shows on the weekend, and then the rest of the week we could play jazz out in the lounge. And one Friday, I'd come in, I'd rehearsed with the new act, and I had my clothes with me and my shaver, and I went back and had some dinner on the steam table. We were allowed to eat once a day free. And I walked past the party room and heard piano. And I thought, well, it's probably either Claude Cifferlin or Steve Ali, wonderful keyboard players, who were playing with John's group. And I peeked inside, and it was John. John's very shy about it. He won't play in front of piano players, or most other people for that matter.
Yeah, but I don't play in front of people.
He knows what he's doing. He knows the instrument, and he composes things. He used to actually write arrangements for that quartet with the two keyboard players, but they would do the notation, do the orchestration, but he knew what he wanted to hear. And he's amazing.
The last time that my trio was in the Midwest, Christoph Ludi and I drove over from Bloomington in the rain on the 52 or something. And we walk into the Wisp, and the lights were out, and we heard sort of Bill Evans harmonies coming from the stage. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't see who was up there because the room was dark. And we stood in the back, and I said, well, we can't go in yet. There's nothing going on, so we'll just wait until the light goes on. And after this beautiful, like, 2 or 3 minutes, you hear, well, okay. And he got up from the piano, and it was him. I had no idea you played that way. And I tried to tell him, you know, how great it was, of course. You know, he wouldn't take it. But I was knocked out. I didn't know you could play piano like that. Mm. It was just beautiful.
I've told John this before, but every so often I listen to him play, and I think to myself, what am I doing on a bandstand with a guy of this caliber?
Oh, yeah.
He's amazing. He's an incredible, complete musician.
I don't want to add to that, too, yet. I know it's been said before, but John just hears all of the music. He's not just hearing music as a drummer or soloist or anything, but yeah, I mean, he hears the entire sound of the band, and I've learned as much about harmony from John, just not even by him necessarily talking about it, but just the way he responds to chords. Like, I'll just play something and he'll give out a little exhortation of, you know, encouragement, yep. Just something like that, and it makes me, you know, and then maybe afterwards he'll say, you got to play that chord again, you know, or just let me know that certain chords and harmonies are meaningful, and so, anyway.
Yeah, I'm a harmony nut.
And you respond to harmony as much as, right,
as much as
other rhythms or, you know, and so, yes, and that relates to how you play solos. You hear the whole song form, and
I think, John, you're the purest natural drummer that I've ever heard play. And I think that those who are wise can be influenced by you if they can let go of what they are doing and totally immerse themselves in your way of thinking at the instrument. And you've single-handedly shaped my playing more than anybody that I've come into contact with. Hmm. And I think that more people should know about you and what you do with the music and the instrument that you play. And I'm doing my best to try to bring that to the forefront. But
yeah,
I just don't know a more natural, pure talent. And it's been such a great honor to be able to learn some of that from you over the years.
Yeah.
And I'd simply like to say thank you, John, for being here in Cincinnati. And just, it's, yeah, just making music so much richer.
Well, I'd like to thank you for not being in Los Angeles.
Yeah, right. No, Cincinnati's been good to me. You know, I always tell my students, though, if they're really hot, you know, really good, you know, don't stay here. You know, you got to go to New York or L.A. You know, and I said, if you want to come back here, you know, when you're 50, fine. But don't do it now, because you can only go so far here. And, of course, things are changing. It could be that you could be in a hometown and then get on a plane, just go anywhere you want, but through the Internet, whatever. So that may change. I don't know. But as far as Cincinnati itself, it's a wonderful town to be in musically. But you can only go so far as name and fame if that's what you're looking for. You're going to have to go somewhere else.
So that's how you got 6 nights a week of work. You send everybody out, huh?
Yeah, right.
Well, it's been a real joy. This is a great moment in time, too, to have Steve Schmidt, Lee Stoller, Bob Nave, Carmen DeLeon, Jeff Hamilton. Thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us and drive in from Indiana. And John Von Olin.
You've been listening to a roundtable discussion in honor of legendary drummer John Von Olin, who plays on a regular basis at the DeFelice Cafe and Shane Nora in Covington, Kentucky, as well as the Blue Wisp Jazz Club in downtown Cincinnati. You can find links to these clubs along with photos of the roundtable taping at wvxu.org. Jeff Hamilton will be performing with Diana Krall at Fraze Pavilion in Kettering on July 7th. A thank you to Chelsea Vandedrink for technical assistance and our moderator, Robin Carey Allgaier. A Celebration of John Von Olin was produced by Lee Hay for 91.7 WVXU.